You're listening to CPA Review, and more you're listening to CPA Review, and more you're listening to CPA Review, and more you're listening to CPA Review, and more. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you're joining from. And thank you for listening to this episode of CPA Review and More with your host, Phil Yeager. I'm your producer and director here at the Yeager Studios, Rob Medford. And together, we are bringing you the number one podcast for CPAs and CPA candidates. If you're new to the show, I'd like to be the first to thank you for checking us out. We're excited to have you as part of our listenership. If you're here because you've already heard our show and you're a continued listener, we thank you for the ongoing support. It's always greatly appreciated. If you're in the market for a CPA review course or simply want to know more about what Yeager CPA Review has to offer, check out our website at YeagerCPAReview.com or call our office and we'll answer any questions you might have. The link and telephone number will be in the description of this episode. Here at Team Yeager, we're excited to tell you about our new Yeager CPA Review subscription format. It's the same great Yeager CPA Review course that you know and love on an all-new month-to-month, no long-term commitment subscription format. But without any further delay, I'm going to pass the microphone on over to your host, Phil Yeager.
Hello, everyone. This is Phil Yeager of Yeager CPA Review. I'm here with Ron Primarosa, all right, who is a college professor at several universities in the country. And Ron is up in Montana, and I'm in Maryland. And Ron's area is BEC and auditing, and he knows it very well. He also knows financial accounting, all right, and he doesn't like regulation. Why? He never does his tax return. But that will be a secret for all of us. And all right, this will be an hour, and we'd love for you to ask questions, you know? If you have any last time we ran this, we had so many questions. It was really enjoyable. So what we did was we did the first half hour basically talking about topics that give students the most trouble, and I'm going to let Ron start with that, and then I'm going to talk about the actual new, they said there's no new blueprints for the first and second quarter of 2020, but they have some new topics. And when I called up and said, well, where do these new topics fall, all right, with the blueprints? And they said, oh, they're already there. Now, Ron and I went through these blueprints, the existing blueprints. I did not see them there. So my answer would be, all right, we have these, we're putting them in the book, all right, and they're going to ask very basic questions. They're basically four or five areas that you should know. And I will tell you what the changes are. That's what I'll do. And also, I'll mention some of the things that people have trouble with in financial accounting based on talking to people. And we do talk to a lot of people. Now, this webinar will be on our podcast page. All right. It'll take a couple of days to get on there. But if you go to our podcast, CPA Review and More. And also, if you go to our homepage and you go to the resource tab, click on the resource, and you'll see webinars. It'll also be there. So let's, without any further ado, let's talk to Ron. Ron, go ahead, please.
Hi, Phil. And by the way, you're right. You're Maryland. I'm Montana. We could say M&Ms. And by the way, I have a thing of M&Ms right next to me here.
Oh, God, I love M&Ms.
Yes, Costco. Yes. I know. It's hard to resist them. Yeah. So I'd like to welcome everyone to this podcast. And Phil has asked me to speak on for auditing and also for BEC. One of the topics that I'm hearing from students or candidates quite often that are troubling to them. So let me start, Phil, with BEC. And what I hear from a lot of candidates is they're worried about the written communication question, Phil. Okay. And there's three of them. All right. It's not one, not two, but there's three of them, Phil. On the BEC part of the exam, and there's four other task-based simulations on BEC. So, you know, this is not an inconsequential part, right, Phil, of this part of the exam, okay? And it's only on the BEC part of the exam that you as a candidate have to deal with written communication questions. So what is the written communication question? Well, Generally, it's a case study which involves some type of a writing skills exercise that you have to perform as a candidate. Generally, you're given some type of situation, business situation, or scenario, and you're asked to write a response to that situation or scenario. So this could be, Phil, you know, drafting a short letter, drafting some type of memorandum, okay, providing the correct information about the situation or the scenario in a very clear, complete, concise, and professional manner, okay? So what I've been doing, Phil, is I advise candidates, how do you maximize your points on these three written communication questions? And to be honest, Phil, I stole from you, Phil. I hate to tell you this, okay? But you had your webcast recently with Mike Decker, right, of the AICPA investigation.
Yeah, that was
division,
a couple
right?
weeks ago, but yes.
He's a couple weeks ago, but he's the VP, and you asked him some very poignant and direct questions about the written communication questions on BEC. And this is a short summary of what Mike said, Phil. First, the ICPA is looking for you to write a strong introductory paragraph, okay? Second, a fact-based middle paragraph, right, where you're addressing the scenario or the question and developing either choices or alternatives to that, whatever that scenario or question. And then finally, a strong concluding paragraph, Phil. I recommend such and such for this reason as an answer to this scenario, okay? In other words, you need to finish your argument with a conclusion, okay? So also writing ability, grammar, and sentence structure, Phil, are important, okay? They're not the most critical part of your answer, but they are important, right? And it could distract the computer grading, right, of this question. These are all computer graded, right, Phil? Except in cases where you're close to passing and they might put in a college professor to kind of review your written communication response. So here's a couple other key points, Phil. Stay on topic, Phil. Don't wander away from the situation or the scenario that they've asked you to address. Don't copy and paste. Believe it or not, some candidates copy or paste the situation or the scenario word for word into their answer, okay? Well, they're not looking for that, Phil. You're not going to earn points by copying and pasting what they're asking you to address in the simulation or the scenario, okay? This is interesting. Do not convey information in the form of a table, bullet point listing, or other type of abbreviated presentation. They want sentences, complete sentences, facts, information, scenarios, possibilities, and conclusions. So don't waste your time on making beautiful tables or bullet point listings or these types. So Phil, I refer the candidates listening to this webcast. We have some excellent examples in our materials, Phil, of written communication questions where the client has requested a simple, straightforward explanation, for example, of the difference between the risk-adjusted discount rate and the time-adjusted discount rates on capital projects, right? That could be a typical BEC simulation question. What's the difference in these discount rates, and how does that affect the evaluation of capital projects, okay? Finally, Phil, on these written communication questions, the expectation is you know how to write, obviously, right, Phil? You've been to college. You learned how to write in college. You actually learned how to write in grade school and in high school, but there's an expectation that you know how to write. Spelling's not important, Phil, okay? It's not critical, but there is spell check in there. Why not use it, right? So in case someone's coming in to grade your response, and you're at 74 and they're trying to decide whether to put you up to 75 or not and pass you, it doesn't distract, you know, a person like you or me reading your answer, okay? So it's also a very good idea, Phil, to review the sample exam tests on the AICPA website, right? Where again, you can practice the some questions that the AICPA has put up, which are potential simulation questions. Now, again, these are potential questions. Doesn't mean you're gonna get those, right, Phil? Could be anything within the blueprints on BEC, right, that you could have a simulation question. And then, Phil, you always recommend, and I agree with you, Grammarly, EDU, is also a good possibility or alternative to practice your writing and communication skills. And Jaeger has no connection with Grammarly. That's
all right. We don't have any, we are not compensated by Grammarly in any way.
Yeah, we have no connection with Grammarly, but if for those of you a little uncertain about your writing ability, writing a letter, writing a note, why not practice on Grammarly a little bit, right? Just to get familiar with that if you're not doing that in your current job or in where you're working today.
I got the idea that these business written communications, all right, there's no one answer. Is that correct?
That's correct, Phil. I mean, as you know, Phil, it can be a question or the scenario could be anything, right, from the blueprints, okay?
But I'm saying the way you answer it, what was the example you gave?
Okay, strong introductory paragraph, okay? Substantive middle paragraph, right, with alternatives and possibilities, right, answering the question or the scenario, and a very strong assertive, right, backed up, including paragraph, right, based on the information that you write in that middle paragraph.
And I think people have different alternatives, right?
Yes, of course.
And they could have different conclusions. So that's what I'm saying. There's no one answer.
No one answer. Exactly, Phil. And as long as what you've written makes sense, right, with your introduction and your middle paragraph and your conclusion, you're going to get points, okay? They're looking for certain keywords and buzzwords from the study materials as you answer scenarios or questions. No, Phil, there's no perfect answer.
And of the three written communications,
yes,
they only count two. Is that correct?
They only count two, and those two count 15% of your grade, okay? So, you know, it is important, okay, to do well on those. And you have your regular SIMS, but that 15%, if you can get 10, 12, 13% of it, right, Phil? You know, that could be the difference between passing or not passing.
Don't try to outguess the AICPA which one they don't count or which ones they do count. Yes. Answer all three.
Yes,
to the best
of
your ability.
Yes, the best that you can. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, Phil, so that's BEC. And now I'll move to auditing. And again, the question I get the most is, and which I also ask candidates a question when they book me through our instructor hotline, is I don't understand the audit reports, Phil. I don't understand under what circumstance the auditor should issue what type or which type of auditor. And again, Phil, our material starting in chapter 4 of auditing, we have a beautiful, Phil, first couple of pages, which explains very concisely and very clearly when do you issue, of course, the non-qualified, right? The clean opinion, we call it. That's hopefully on most audits. But, you know, the exam's looking, Phil, for whether or not you understand. When do you issue a qualified opinion, a disclaimer of opinion, an adverse opinion? And even trickier, Phil, is the emphasis of a matter opinion, where you still have a unmodified clean opinion, but the auditor is in a situation where they need to emphasize a matter, okay? And then there's other matters.
Is that one of the blueprints, the emphasize of matter?
Oh, yes, Phil. Okay. Absolutely. Yep. All of these are in the blueprint, okay? And yes. I want to emphasize, Phil, it's not important to memorize all the different types and forms of opinion, okay? But it is important to understand the format of the auditor's report, okay? Which, of course, has recently changed, and I'm not going to address that in this particular webcast. You can see it in our materials because the PCAOB has changed, right, the format of the standard audit report to emphasize critical audit matters and other points in the auditor's opinion. But you got to start, I think, in auditing with the audit reports to a certain extent, and you need to understand under what circumstance you issue each one of these. And let me quickly summarize those. The qualified opinion, right, which is the famous except for, right, in the paragraph, is when you have a major departure from a gap, right? And of course, it's got to be material, Phil. It can't be little stuff, okay? It's got to be material. Or the client that you're auditing has placed a major scope limitation on your audit. So for example, if inventory is 50% of the assets and the client says, sorry, you can't observe the physical inventory at year end in the process of performing your audit, you may deem that, unless you can do alternative audit procedures, right, as a major scope limitation. So those are the qualified opinion situations. Disclaimer is when there's a very major scope limitation, pervasive to the audit. So say accounts receivable are 90% of assets and the client says, sorry, can't see my accounts receivable aging, can't confirm the receivables with our customers, and can't verify the existence of the revenues recorded in the accounts receivable. That, Phil, would be a very major pervasive scope limitation, which doesn't allow the auditor really to issue any type of an opinion except a disclaimer, okay? Third one, Phil, is adverse opinion. So for example, if you have a client who doesn't use the allowance method, right, for accounts receivable, and instead uses the bad debt or the actual write-off method for bad debts, right, that's an obvious departure from generally accepted accounting principle, because under accrual accounting, you must use the allowance method, right, for financial statements prepared in accordance with GAAP. And that's a major departure, especially if accounts receivable or material right to the total assets of the company. So that's an example of an adverse. Emphasis of a matter, you can still issue an unmodified opinion, but you want to emphasize something as the auditor, is where you have a going concern issue, right, with that company, right? You performed your audit, financial statements are fairly stated, but there is a going concern consideration, right? Maybe the client has violated its debt covenants, right, and hasn't received yet a waiver from the bank for the violation of those debt covenants, which then would trigger an immediate repayment, right, of that debt. That's that could trigger a going concern. That could be an emphasis of a matter. Or the inconsistent application, Phil, of accounting principles from one period to another. FIFO, last period for inventory, this period changed to LIFO. Okay, that's an emphasis of a matter. And then there are other matters and an auditor could also emphasize, Phil, in their opinion, like legal matters, right? Like unresolved key important litigation across against the company where the lawyer has not expressed an opinion either way as to the ultimate outcome of the litigation. Okay, Phil, so that's a good summary in auditing, Phil, of a matter. And we have in our book lots of mobile choice questions covering this, lots of simulation questions covering this with what ifs. Okay, what if this happens? What if this happens? What if that happens? The materiality context and how it affects audit opinions. Of course, this is a big topic, right, Phil, in the blueprints. And definitely, you may get a simulation question on this. You certainly will get multiple choice questions testing whether or not you know when to issue which type of audit opinion. So, Phil, over to you for my two favorite subjects, which I know nothing about, which is Reg, starting with Reg.
Well, let's talk about Reg. Once again, there are no blueprint changes for the first and second quarter of 2020. So you know there's no blueprint. They're probably still testing the tax year 2018. They will tell us, the course providers, when they meet in March with the ASCP examination division, when they will start testing 2019 tax laws, all right? But they usually do not test things that change from year to year. They don't do that. And also, don't memorize phase outs, all right? You don't have to know phase out amounts. You don't have to know tax rates for every situation, all right? They're going to ask you the same thing year after year after year. For example, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has been fully implemented as of 2019, all right? So that's in there. And let's talk about some of the areas in entities. People have trouble with corporate taxes, partnership taxation, when I talk about corporations, I'm talking about C-Corps and S-Corps. All right. Now, you have to know different things. For example, all right, a popular area in corporations, S-Corp and C-Corps, is when they have liquidations of the corporation, right? Whether it's a total liquidation or a partial liquidation, all right? Partial is called a current distribution, all right? But you have to know, you know, when they distribute the assets in a distribution, whether it's a partnership or a corporation, what's the basis of the asset to the shareholder, the person who is getting that asset, all right? You got to know these rules. And, all right, there's another rule where if you transfer in assets to a corporation, whether it's a C-Corp or an S-Corp, all right, if you get control of that company, of that corporation, that means 80% or more of all classes of stock, and this applies to S-Corps as well as C-Corps, all right, you have no taxable event with the corporation. However, there is an exception where if you get 80% of the stock or more, all right, and remember, you got to transfer in assets. No, you don't transfer in your own stock. It's got to be property, assets you transfer in, for the 80% or more interest. And please remember, the person who actually receives the stock, the 80% or more, can still have a gain if they receive BOOT. BOOT, all right, which is cash, all right? BOOT would be, let's talk about where you get, they give you short-term securities, all right? Now, if you receive cash or short-term securities in another company, all right, you take the fair market value of the short-term securities plus the cash, the BOOT you receive, you add those together, and that's the portion of the realized gain that is recognized. So you can still have a recognized gain even though you get control. And what I do is, to make sure I'm actually giving you the right material, I give you the blueprints integrated within our notes, okay? And You have to know, like on a partnership return, an S-corporation return, all right? What items are used to calculate ordinary income, which is the first calculation on a partnership return, 1065, or an 1120S, all right? And then the items that are not used to arrive at ordinary income, both income and deductions, all right? They are shown separately stated on Schedule K and K-1. And also, you have to know how to calculate a partner's basis in the partnership, and you have to know how to calculate the S-corporation shareholders' basis in the stock of the S corporation. These are things they ask, and they're always the same things they ask, all right? Just like, right, when a corporation gives a dividend, all right, what happens, all right? How does it affect the stockholder? Also, if you have a corporation that invests in another corporation stock, all right, and they receive a cash dividend, remember, all right, they will get a dividend received deduction depending upon what percentage of stock they now own in that other company. These are all things they ask. I can promise you that. And I'm not going to try to actually cover that now. But what would I know? All right. I would make sure that you know all of the new changes in the Trump Tax Act. That's the Jobs Cuts Act. All right. And also, all right, if there are any changes, I can't think of any changes in corporate or partnership taxation. All right. Because that does not change. And remember, don't worry about phase out amounts. Don't worry about tax rates. And also now on the regulation, all right, they show actual dates. They don't show 20X8. They'll show 2018 because certain provisions went into effect in 17 and then certain provisions went into effect in 18 under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, all right? So you have to know what year they're dealing with. So they give actual dates on regulation, okay? And don't forget, you got to know business law. They're going to give you 13 or 14 business law questions. What do people have trouble with? Secured transactions, all right? They don't have any idea what some of those terms mean. Now, if English is a second language, it's even worse. But even though you don't have English as your second language and it's your primary language, they still don't understand business law because a lot of them, all right, were taught a course that maybe, all right, the person who taught it to them did not explain these concepts. Or maybe they just skipped over it. Because when I went to school, we had two semesters of business law. Now there's only one semester, all right? And the blueprints tell you what areas of business law, all right, they will test.
Phil, I have a question for you, Phil, is what do you believe are some of the most critical areas to go over in terms of individual taxation, in your opinion?
Well, I would know, first of all right, the items that are now taxable income, okay, all right? And I'm trying to think, basically, that hasn't changed. You know, gross dividends, all right, interest income, unemployment compensation. If you have net rental income, that's taxable, all right? And also, if you gamble and you win the lottery or gambling winnings are part of the gross income. Now, that really hasn't changed as far as I can remember. But what has changed is the deductions to arrive at AGI or from gross income to arrive at AGI. A lot of the old ones, like moving expenses, they've been taken away, all right? So, you know, you have to know what items are still deductible to arrive at AGI. And then make sure you know the itemized deductions because the itemized deductions have changed, especially the miscellaneous 2% itemized deductions, which are no longer deductible on a 1040. The miscellaneous 2% are gone, like tax preparation fees. You know, investment counsel fees. And also, personal casualty losses are no longer calculated nor deductible. They eliminated that, okay? But even though they eliminated the miscellaneous 2%, the ones that have to exceed 2% of AGI, there's a miscellaneous which does not have to exceed 2%. The best example of that is gambling losses. You still can deduct gambling losses against gambling winnings. Remember that, right? But that's what I would know. And I think if you go through the 1040, you know, go down every line of the 1040. Look at the 2018 1040, all right? That's when the rules were in effect. And just go down every line and make sure you know what is the limits on each one, all right? For example, charitable contributions is still an itemized deduction, but now, all right, it can't exceed more than 60% of AGI. They changed those, okay? I would know that 60% because that's permanent now. So that's what I would do. Go through the return. Also, make sure you know the supporting schedules. Schedule A, itemized deductions. B, interest and dividend income. C, make sure you know how to calculate net earnings from self-employment. If you're a self-employed person, a consultant, all right, your income is shown on Schedule C, and any expenses of business are shown also as deduction on Schedule C to arrive at net earnings from self-employment. Then you take the net earnings from self-employment and you bring it over to Schedule SE and compute self-employment tax. All right. The Schedule D, we have capital gains and losses. E, which is supplemental income. F is farming. All right. And that's the ones I would look at. Just you have to know the forms. All right. You have to know the rules. But here's the situation. You say, well, what forms do I have to know? All right. The question just asked me, what do I have to know on individuals? Well, you know something? If the course you're taking has the blueprints, they tell you what items and individuals you have to know. All right. So you don't have to guess. All right. That's the point of the blueprints. They tell you what's going to be on the exam, nothing more, nothing less. Now, they're not going to ask all the areas at one time, all right, because that would be an exam which would be 15 hours, you know, 15 hours of financial, all right? They don't ask all the blueprints, but they expect you to be familiar with the blueprints, okay? Any other question on that?
No. Thank you, Phil. Very good answer. Okay. Another question I just got is, Does your review course have videos for each part?
Yes, it does. We have streaming video, and we are a teaching course. And the streaming video you get, all right, is in sync. You can see the book right next to it, and you can see what the instructor is lecturing from. And our books are integrated with the blueprints. I don't know of any other course that does that. But yes, we have videos. They're teaching videos, and they are current and up to date. And if they change the blueprints, we will change that topic and refilm it. So to answer your question, yes, it's a video course. It's a teaching course, all right? No PowerPoint, no memorizing, all right? And also, we include a cram course at the end, all right? Because what you cover in the beginning of your studying, you may forget at the end. So the cram course, which is a video course, which reviews everything, all right, will bring back those items that are in your brain that you can't find. They come up, okay? That's what the CRAM does, all right? Now, let me talk about some changes, all right? They actually have put into the exam effective for January 2nd, 2020, okay? Now, I contacted the ASCPA, and I said to them, wait a minute, there's no change in the blueprints. How can you have changes starting on 2020? And their answer was, these changes are already reflected in the blueprints. Now, I have to honestly tell you, I couldn't find where they would be in the blueprints. Ron looked at it, I looked at it, but there aren't that many. So if they give you multiple choice on it, I don't expect any sims on this, just be familiar with it. And by the way, I will be putting this two-page update on our site, give us about 5 days, all right? And it'll say on our site, updates, all right? Effective for January 2nd, 2020, all right? And they are dealing with, one, financial instruments credit losses, all right? That's one. All right, intangibles, goodwill, and other. And what they're doing there is they're simplifying the test for goodwill impairment. That's what they did. All right, the third one they did was fair value measurement, disclosure requirements for fair value measurement. All right, and the amendments apply to all entities that are required under existing GAAP to make disclosure about recurring and non-recurring fair value measurement. All right, you read this, it'll make sense. I'm just giving you, you know, the first paragraph of what I have there. And then the next one is ASU 2019-03 for not-for-profit entities. They updated the definition of collections. Remember, not-for-profits, all right, they receive, you know, paintings, all right, they receive antiques, all right, that's how, and they sell them, all right. So now, what is the definition of those collections they get from selling these collectibles and antiques, all right? They've changed the definition of the collections. All right. And also, you have to show the disclosure of how or what that definition is. And then we had two changes on GASB, all right, the governmental accounting standards. All right. And one deals with how a governmental unit, that's GASB, all right, how they deal with leases. Now, well, I can tell you this, all right, under GASB for governmental units, all right, they're dealing with the same lease rules as we use in GAAP, but they only have financing leases, finance leases. They don't have operating leases. That's a big difference between GAAP and GASB, all right? But other than that, the entries are similar, all right? So if you understand it from the standpoint of GAAP, the leases, you'll know the rules for GASB. But remember, what's the main difference? There's only a finance lease under GASB for the lessee, lessor, and the operating leases are no longer in effect under GASB. They're still in effect for financial accounting. And then the last one is accounting for interest costs incurred before the end of a construction period. All right. Now, if the governmental unit is constructing something, it used to be if there was any interest costs on the construction loan, not the lawn. All right. I'll repeat that. If they paid any interest on the construction loan, all right, that interest used to be have to be capitalized. It was part of the asset. But now what they've said is all interest with those construction loans are now expensed. They're now expensed. These are not really difficult, all right? But I'll have this up there for everyone. Do we have a question coming up?
So, Phil, I got another question is, how do you recommend studying for and tackling any simulation questions you get on financial statements for not-for-profit entities? I know that's one of your good subjects.
Right? First of all, I can tell you this. Generally, not-for-profit and governmental are 20 multiple choice. Okay. They're generally not simulations, okay? And of those 20, 16 of them are for governmental, 3 of them are not-for-profit. So okay. The chances are you will not have a simulation on not-for-profit. Does that answer that?
Yep, that was one of the questions. And just studying for it in general, Phil, what do you recommend?
The blueprints for governmental and not-for-profit state exactly what they expect you to know. Now, if you don't look at the blueprints or your course doesn't give it to you, then it's sort of like, I give the analogy, it's like going bowling without seeing the pins. The bowling is taking the exam. You don't see the areas they're testing on, you're going to be out of your mind. They're making it easier for you. They're giving you the tasks, the simulations. Now, if the course does not integrate it, you better get a copy of the blueprints. So at least you see what the areas are. Now, it's not going to explain the information under each blueprint like we do in our course, all right? But you got to look at those blueprints.
Phil, if for the candidates not taking our course at the moment, where can they access the blueprints, Phil?
You go to AICPA.org, all right? In the search box, put blueprints effective July 1st, 2019.
Okay.
You have the blueprints for financial, every part.
Yep.
And also tell you the percentage, how it's broken down. Like multiple choice, a 50%, simulations of 50%.
So there's a separate blueprint, right, Phil, for each part of the exam,
Separate blueprint for each part. They tell you the percentages. They tell you how many multiple choice there are. This is what I offered last time. I have a calendar that you can make an appointment to talk to me. You can make an appointment, even though you're not our student. I'd be happy to discuss anything you want to discuss, all right, in that half hour session. Honestly, all right, everyone out there, if you're not taking us, you can call me, all right? I'm a lonely person. I like to talk to people. So anyway, seriously, you're saying, wait a minute, you mean he will talk to anybody? And the answer is yes. And even better, I will talk to people on weekends. This is not a business that ends at 5 o'clock Friday night, all right? By the way, you actually talk to me or Ron. You don't talk to some customer service. I actually called myself the advocate for the CPA candidate. What areas do people have trouble with in financial accounting? I heard through the grapevine, all right, they actually asked a bank reconciliation. I spoke to people and they didn't know how to do a bank rec. Now, you know what you do? You always start with the ending bank balance for the month and you compare that to the ending book balance that's in your checkbook. And then there's items that are used for reconciliation to bring them both together, all right? For example, if you had deposits in transit, Ron, I'm going to test you on this.
Oh, no, Phil, all please right. Don't embarrass me, okay?
I wouldn't embarrass you.
Okay.
All right, if you have a deposit in transit, all right, is that added to the bank balance or the books? Well, is it on the books, deposits in transit?
Yes. You've already recorded it.
It's not on the bank statement because it hasn't cleared the bank. So you're going to add it to the bank, all right? Outstanding checks, all right? Now, people say, what's an outstanding check? Well, really, we don't have checks anymore, right? We may have e-checks. But I used to say an outstanding check is when you look at a check and you say, gee, that's outstanding, all right? But I still get bigger laughs. I really did when we did live courses. But anyway, all right. Outstanding checks. These are checks that have been written by the customer, client, all right, but they have not cleared the bank. So they've been deducted from your books, but they have not been deducted from the bank, subtracted from the bank.
Yep.
All right. And then we have another one. Someone gives you a deposit, all right? Someone gives you a deposit for the services you provided them, all right? And they give you a check that doesn't clear the bank. Non-sufficient funds, all right? Now, what do you do with that? Well, first of all right, you got that deposit. You, the company, you added that to your books. But the bank said there's not enough funds in that person's account, all right, to cover that. So therefore, the bank did not add it to the bank statement balance for you. All right. So what do you have to do? You have to do this. You have to reduce the books because this is not a valid deposit on the books if there's not enough funds in the bank to clear that. Okay. So non-sufficient funds, you subtract from the book balance. Now, another thing, bank service fees. All right. What do you do with a service fee? Bank charge. Well, the bank has already deducted it, but you have not deducted it on your books. So what do? Deducted on your book balance. Now, when you actually, by the way, any reconciling items on the side that says company books, you have to make journal entries for because you're correcting your cash balance on the books. So any reconciling items that go on the book side, you have to make journal entries for so you correct your cash balance. Now, when you reconcile both sides, it's called the correct cash balance, all right? Let me repeat that. You don't call it the correct bank statement balance. You don't call it the correct book balance. You call it, both sides, the correct cash balance. That's what you're reconciling to on both sides. All right? Now, any questions on that? Do we get any questions on that?
No.
Okay. All right. Now, the next thing is they always give they always give business combinations. Oh, God. Now, the hardest thing with business combinations is what the heck is a business combination? All right? Well, it is considered where a parent company, all right, has a permanent control. If the parent company has temporary control, all right, they can't consolidate. And the parent owns more than 50% of the outstanding stock of the subsidiary. Now, they change the words here. The parent is now the acquirer, all right? The sub is the acquiree, all right? Now, the bottom line is this, all right? If they say to you, all right, do a consolidation, all right? Remember, the consolidation is considered an acquisition, all right? That's what it is. But this whole process of the consolidation is done on a worksheet, right? Because the parent and the sub continue to operate their own separate companies, have their own separate books. So the bringing together is done on a worksheet. Now, certain entries are actually book entries. Certain entries are worksheet entries. For example, let's assume that I buy an investment in a company and I issue stock, right? I will debit the investment at the interest. If I'm getting a 60% interest, it'll be 60% of the interest that I'm getting in the sub at fair market value. Remember that. The investment represents the interest at fair market value. All right. Now, if I'm issuing my own stock, I'll credit common stock at par value. And the plug is to additional paid in capital in excess of par. That goes on the books. But when you do the consolidation at the end of the period, at the end of the year, all right, there's certain elimination entries. Why? Because when you consolidate, the company that is left is the parent. You are eliminating the subsidiary, all right? So what you have to do is you have to make some adjustments and eliminations on the worksheet. So what do? The first one on the worksheet, all right, is you get rid of the sub's common stock, the sub's APIC, and the sub's retained earnings. Whatever those figures are on the sub side of the trial balance, you just eliminate them, all right? So if you eliminate the sub stockholder's equity, whose stockholders' equity is left? The parent. So the consolidated stockholders' equity is the parent, all right? Then you credit investment in the parent. The parent shows investment in the subsidiary, all right? Now remember, that investment in the subsidiary is at fair market value. When you eliminate the stockholders' equity of the sub, that's at book value. So there's going to be a difference there, all right? Now, what is the difference called? It is called the excess of acquisition cost over the book value of the net assets of the sub. It's the excess of the acquisition cost over the book value of the sub, all right? Now, what's the next entry you have to make on the worksheet? You have to bring up the assets of the sub to fair market value. Now, they will give you the fair market value of the assets of the sub's assets. You got to bring them up to fair value. So if you have to increase the inventory from book value to fair value, and it's 5,000, you debit inventory 5,000. And you do all of these things, all right? They give you the assets. They'll tell you if there's a difference between book value and fair value. Bring it up to fair value, all right? Now, when you bring it up and adjust it to fair value, all right, you're going to eliminate that excess of acquisition costs over the book value of the net assets. So you'll bring all the assets up or down to fair value, all right? You're going to eliminate that excess of acquisition costs over the book value of the net assets by crediting it. And then the plug to the entry is always goodwill. You have a debit to goodwill. Remember, goodwill is on the account you see in consolidations, all right? And that's really it. And you have intercompany receivables and payables, all right? You have, if the parent sells to the sub a fixed asset, a gain or loss, that gain or loss has to be eliminated because you can't sell to yourself, all right? Know these eliminations. There's only certain elimination, all right? Now, I can't go over everyone because we'd be doing a whole class on business combinations. But also, make sure you know the adjustments and eliminations for non-controlling interest, all right? Non-controlling interest.
A couple of students saying, you know, I'm really troubled by the auditing sims. And one of the things we recommend, Phil, as you know.
Why are they troubled by the auditing sims?
Because there's, I think there's a connection, as you know, Phil, between topics and FAR, right? And also auditing, where they, you know, they give you a simulation question and they ask you what to do in a certain scenario. And there's also some accounting theory, right? And FAR connections related to the auditing subject. So yeah. That, you know, it's, and that's why we recommend, right, Phil, taking those two parts.
You got to do FAR first.
Yes.
Generally accepted accounting principles.
Yep.
When you're auditing, you're auditing the financial statements.
Yep.
And you have to audit them in conformity with generally accepted accounting principles. So you learn your gap, right, from financial accounting in order to do your auditing. That could be one of the reasons you
have. And that's the question I just got, Phil. Which test should I take first?
Well, you can actually do regulation first if you like taxes, all right?
Yep.
Regulation
yep.
has nothing to do with anything, right? But usually people do financial accounting first, then they do auditing, then they do regulation, then they do BEC, because the BEC has written communications on either financial, auditing, or tax. You could do, if you're really good in taxes, I would do regulation first, all right?
Yep,
because you want to get one part under your belt.
Yep.
And when you get one part, it gives you that momentum to want to go forward and pass the other parts.
Yep.
Okay?
Here's another great question. How long should I take spending, studying, getting ready for FAR? What's a realistic
time frame? Well, if you are working
frame?
Full-time, it takes about 2.5 to 3 months.
I agree. Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
But if you're not working, you can do it a lot faster.
Yep.
But make sure, all right, you go in there and you know the information. This is not a race. Make sure you know it. And the way our people know it is that they watch that CRAM course, all right? That tells them what they know and what they don't know.
Another question, Phil, quickly, can you cover, I'm having trouble understanding intercompany transactions and what to do with them in the consolidation process?
Okay, well, there's different intercompany transactions, all right? There are, for example, there's intercompany payables and receivables. You can't owe yourself money. You debit payable, credit receivable, all right? Second thing, all right? If a parent or sub sells a fixed asset to itself, all right, at a gain or a loss, all right, because it's one company, all right, if the parent sells to the sub at a gain, the fixed asset, or the sub sells it to the parent. Did I say that right? Parent to sub, sub to parent. What you have to do is eliminate on the worksheet the intercompany gain or loss. You got to bring that asset that was sold back on the books. So if it's equipment, debit the equipment for the original cost. Also, bring back on the books, not on the books, bring back on the worksheet the accumulated depreciation that you wrote off when you sold it, because now you're reinstating it. The sale never occurred. And then we have, what else do we have?
Intercompany receivables and payables, Phil.
Receivables, payables?
Yeah.
What was that? Is that all they wanted?
Yeah, no, that's another part of it, right?
But here, you can have intercompany bonds.
Yep.
All right, which means someone has a debit to investment in bonds.
Yep.
The issuer has bonds payable, and also they might have an unamortized discount, unamortized premium. All right, so therefore, from a consolidation standpoint, your elimination or adjustment for bonds is though you're retiring the bonds. All right, so you figure out what percentage the parent owns of the bonds, If it's 40%, by the way, to consolidate, you don't have to own more than 50% of the bonds. You have to own more than 50% of the stock. All right. So if there's a 30% intercompany bonds, you take 30% of the bonds payable on the trial balance of the issuer. All right. You credit the investment in bonds account. And don't forget to eliminate the percentage of the unamortized discount of premium that relates to those bonds. I mean, there's a lot of entries. Don't forget to eliminate the stockholders' equity against the investment.
Next question is, I'm having trouble auditing pension plans and also investments. And I think I can answer that one, Phil. Again, you need to go to the blueprints on the auditing of pension plans. There are some basic items in there covered in the blueprints under the auditing part of the exam that you're required to know per the blueprints, okay? Basically with pension plans, right? That expenses determined by actuaries, right? Companies fund those plans by making contributions to those plans. And there are some FAR, right, or accounting topics, right, related to computing pension expense that are important to understand when you're auditing a pension plan. So I don't think that's highly possible. I wouldn't say never, but
you have to know that of the components of pension costs, one of them is service costs. Yep. And then you have like four or five other ones.
Yep.
The service cost is now shown on the income statement as operating expense.
Yep.
All right. The remaining costs of the pension, like, you know, actuarial gains and losses, that type of thing, they are shown in the income statement now as other expenses.
Yep.
Okay. That's new.
Yep. And then another question on accounting for investments and auditing investments. Again, you know, there, Phil, as we know, there's many types of investments, right? They're all classified different ways, right? Held to maturity, right? Available for sale, et cetera. Our materials cover that very well, okay? And again, you can see that on a simulation question, right? In auditing, where they're asking you to audit, you know, the accounting for particular investments and how you would audit. And also Bridget says, get back to FAR. She wants more FAR, Phil.
Well, actually, we're going to start doing these webinars every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, we used to do them once a month. And in 1 hour, there's just so much you can cover. Okay. Yep.
And we can get more into depth at that time.
Yeah, you know, we'll try our best. Time. But thank you very much, Bridget. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you once again for participating in our webinar. All right. We do this. You know, people say, why do you do this with people in other courses? Well, really, at this point in my life, okay, all right, I really want to help people. And, all right, I know that we run the best course around. I don't care what anybody says, all right, and you have to look at it to judge. Number one priority for us, what is that?
Pass the exam. Help them pass the exam, Phil.
All right, call me. I'll do what I can to help you, all right? I'll do that for people. People in this business, the students, have been nice to me over the years. Now this is sort of my giving back, if you want to call it that.
Yeah. And our greatest thrill, Phil, is when we get that email after a candidate takes a part or all four parts and they pass and they say to us, I pass, right, Phil? Nothing quite like it. And they pass, right?
We get satisfaction out of it.
Yes. And I'd love to see a copy of their CPA certificate, Phil, once they get it too. Nothing better.
Well, anyway, thank you everyone for participating, and we will have another one in a couple of weeks. Just check our website, all right, and please join us. And I really appreciate the thank yous. It means a lot to us. And I'll wish everyone a good evening wherever you are. Ron, thank you very much, and you have a good evening in Montana, and I'll talk to you soon.
Have a good evening, everyone. Take care. All our best.
Once again, I'd like to thank you for being the best part of CPA Review and More with your host, Phil Yeager. If you have any questions or topics you'd like to hear on the show, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show to share your story, we want to hear from you. Send me an email to the studio at podcast@YeagerCPAReview.com. If you're enjoying the content that we're providing, we'd greatly appreciate it if you'd submit a review to the Apple iTunes podcast app to let us know how we're doing. If you're in the market for a CPA review course or simply want to find out more about the CPA exam and what Yeager has to offer, check out YeagerCPAReview.com or call our office and we'll answer any questions you may have. The link and the phone number will be in the description of this podcast. Here at Team Yeager, We're excited to tell you about our new Jaeger CPA Review subscription format. It's the same great Jaeger CPA Review course that you know and love on an all-new month-to-month, no-commitment subscription format. Check it out today. Once again, my name's Rob Medford. I'm your executive producer and director here at the Jaeger Studios. And until next time, take care and be audit you can be.